welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 8th of March 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Once again, it's the beginning of another week. We look forward to an exciting week in Britain and we are here today to discuss the past exciting week in Britain with my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. It's a little bit overcast here today. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. It's a lovely sunny day here, actually. And just as last weekend, I've been out for a good long cycle ride. So I'm continuing my fitness regime and I'm feeling really good at the moment. And as you say, looking forward to the week ahead.
Excellent stuff. Excellent stuff. And it is good to hear that you're out there keeping fit. I would hope that lots of people, while they've been on this COVID lockdown, have actually managed to improve their fitness, doing things like that. I know it's a shame that all these gyms have been closed down and people really haven't been able to manage to keep their physique how they wanted it, but at least they've been able to get out and about in the countryside and walk and cycle and all those sort of things that we like to do. And the first news story that we've got today, it concerns Prince Harry and this Oprah Winfrey interview, and we've really not been able to hear about anything else on the news over the last week to do with Harry and his wife Meghan. Max, you've been looking into this in particular, haven't you? Do you want to give us a recap of what's been going on there and what your thoughts are?
Well, once I've been looking into it in the sense that I've got knowledge of matters pertaining to it that wouldn't necessarily be in the public domain, but I've just got some insights, I suppose, into the background to this whole affair. And I think it is an unfolding tragedy, and it's an unfolding tragedy both for Prince Harry and also for the royal family, really. And the big message that it would appear that Harry and Meghan want to put out from this discussion that they're having with Oprah Winfrey is that they feel that the royal family needs to be rethought, and people that are close to Meghan and Harry have been making statements suggesting that the royal family is overdue a restructuring because it's no longer fit for the purpose that it traditionally has fulfilled. And to some extent they're right, and that's all part of this kind of unfolding tragedy, which is that Harry finds himself in a very difficult situation. He finds himself in a difficult situation because he's the younger brother of the heir to the throne, and so therefore the whole point of his existence is to be the understudy to his older brother in case his older brother dies, and so that he then takes the place of his older brother. And so at the point when Harry was born, he was already third in line to the throne then, because there would have been Prince Charles and then William ahead of him. And so for Harry to lead anything other than just a life as an understudy for his big brother, what he really needed was for the Queen, for Prince Charles, and for Prince William to all die in fairly swift succession, and then he would then be in line for the throne. But then as the years have gone by, William has married, and William has subsequently had two sons, and so Harry is now pushed back in terms of the line of succession, and it means that for him, any possibility of him becoming king is becoming increasingly remote. And the situation that would have existed in times gone by, in times of old when kings used to lead their armies into battle, then person born the younger brother of the person who is the heir to the throne would have always had the prospect that their older brother might have died in battle before he eventually became king. Or that he might have succumbed to some kind of illness or whatever and died before he became king, and so therefore the younger brother had a chance of becoming the king. But Harry has been denied that. That there is very little prospect of all of the people that are in front of him in line for the throne all dying and him becoming the king. So as long as he stays within the royal family, he will only ever be understudy to his big brother, and now understudy to his big brother's two sons. And so you can see that somebody in Harry's position would have very frustrating feelings of lacking any sense, real sense of purpose in their life, because they're the understudy for a role that in all probability they will never be cast in. And so it's a very debilitating position to be in my view. I would find it quite sort of strange and quite horrible to be in that situation where that was the case.
I think you're being very kind there, Max. Just let me say, I think you're being very kind there, because I think they really missing the public perception of this. And if you're a prince, you're one of the luckiest people in the world. He's had everything he could ever wish for. Okay, his mother died. That was very sad. But he had the best education. He's got all the wealth in the world. He could have his pick from the women. I mean, literally, absolutely everything is at his fingertips. And then he's there complaining about how hard the life is for him. And he's got his wife there complaining about how she wasn't allowed to have a voice. She's been paid to be a princess. I mean, this is something that little girls dream of, that this woman was given. And Harry is just there going along with it and saying that he wants to leave the royal family and make it on his own. But at the same time, he still wants to be prince, and he still wants to go along to all these ceremonies that they have. He still wants to be involved in that. And you can't do both of these things all together. And at the same time as doing this, there's an investigation going on at the palace that Meghan Markle bullied her staff, and the palace tried to cover this up. And she's saying, oh, this is just tittle-tattle and they're just trying to make me look bad. But this has been going on for a year and a half, and the palace were good enough to try and cover this up and try and keep the people quiet, and they're now being accused of making this stuff up. It's just incredible that they like to put across this image of them standing up for the poor, standing up for the downtrodden, standing up for the bullied, and yet their staff say that they were the bullies. And Harry is, instead of saying to his wife, look, you need to speak to the staff a little bit better than this, he's saying what Meghan wants, Meghan gets. It just seems very, very hypocritical to me. And I think they've completely missed the public's perception of them, because, as I say, that they have absolutely everything that they could wish for, and they have everything that the general members of the public would wish for, and yet they're not happy and they want people to feel sorry for them. Just incredible.
Well, materially, you're absolutely correct that they do have everything they've ever wanted. But and you're quite right that becoming a princess is the sort of thing that little girls dream of. But that's what little girls dream of. That's not what adult women dream of. And you've only got to look at people that achieve celebrity in other fields. People, for example, that become rock stars, where they, in many cases, they're not particularly good musicians. They are competent musicians. They're not particularly good singers. They're competent singers. But because they happen to be the ones that have been chosen by the media moguls who promote the pop and rock industry, they get promoted to such an extent that they suddenly become fabulously wealthy. Or where you get footballers who are pretty good at playing football, but not necessarily uniquely so, and who get paid astronomical salaries so that they don't want for anything. So they've got so much money, they can buy anything they want. And the point is, if you've got so much money, you can buy everything you want, and you haven't really had to work that hard to get it, apart from playing football or singing on a stage, then the life doesn't have a great deal of purpose. And and you've only got to look at the dangerous relationships that Prince Andrew has forged during the course of his career as somebody who was effectively waiting for his older brother and everybody else ahead of him in line of succession to die. You know, the devil makes work for idle hands, and there are all sorts of temptations, and you end up with situations where rock stars and people who've had celebrity thrown upon them, but whose lives have otherwise been meaningless, striving for something more than just this life of material pleasure, and therefore turning to becoming desperately unhappy, suffering mental illness, turning to drugs and killing themselves and dying at a very early age. Or like some footballers turning to alcoholism and simply dying at an early age. And so being somebody who's had material wealth thrust upon them isn't the be all and end all of human existence. And if you look at your life, if you've been born into that kind of wealth, then that kind of wealth means nothing to you. It's just something that you take for granted. And then you'd think to yourself, what shall I do with my life? What is my life? What's the purpose of my life? And if the purpose of your life is to stand in line, waiting for an opportunity that you know is never, ever going to come to you, then that is going to set up all sorts of frustrations. And the situation with Harry is that Harry was born and at quite an early age had a terrible shock, which was the death of his mother. And what he could see with his mother was that she was somebody who had joined the royal family and who was desperately unhappy being a member of the royal family. The reason why she was desperately unhappy being a member of the royal family was because Charles always had a greater affection for Camilla Parker Bowles than he had for her, or appears to have done anyway. But you know, that appears to be the case. And as far as Diana was concerned, she wasn't happy with that situation. She was a naive person who didn't realise that royal marriages are arranged marriages, and they're not marriages built upon love in the same way that people think about marriage ordinarily. They're often marriages of convenience, uniting two royal families together, etc. And as far as the British monarchy is concerned, you know, the British monarchy was no different. And Diana expected that she would have this kind of fairy tale existence, but then found out that the fairy tale wasn't quite as fairy tale as she wanted. And she revolted against the royal family, and she went off to pursue a life of celebrity and effectively treated the royal family at the firm, as Prince Philip refers to it, as kind of like an enemy. That she developed this fixation that the press were her enemy, that the royal family were her enemy, and then she died tragically. And Harry has been brought up with sort of steeped in that story, in a situation where he sees himself as having no real purpose in life, and yet he's still confined by all of the conventions and the customs of the royal family, and so he again feels imprisoned. Or my interpretation of his situation is that he felt imprisoned by that, and felt that he wanted his life to have more relevance than for him just to be the understudy for a job he was never going to be offered. His only way out of that situation is to leave the royal family and then compete with the royal family for on the basis of celebrity, which is the example that was set to him by his mother, and it would appear that he's following in her footsteps in that respect. The really tragic aspect to all of this, though, is that what Harry doesn't realise is that if he damages the institution of the monarchy, he also damages the only thing that gives him his relevance. Because unlike a rock star, unlike a famous dancer, unlike a world-class athlete, he isn't famous for his ability to sing. He's not famous for his ability to dance. And he's not a world-class athlete. His entire celebrity is based upon the fact that he was born into the royal family, an accident of birth. And if he damages the royal family through the actions that he's pursuing with the kind of interview that he's going to have with Oprah Winfrey, then he is undermining his own celebrity by damaging the royal family. And so it's a tragedy for all concerned, but a double tragedy for him, because the only route that he can see out of the kind of gilded cage that he's in is to destroy the cage, which then undermines his own importance as a celebrity. And so therefore, if he does too much, you know, and if this conversation that he has with Oprah damages the royal family and damages it too much, then he will suffer from that himself.
I think you make a good point there by bringing up Prince Andrew. And I think this is the challenge that he should have been looking at. I've got all these temptations, all these temptations to do bad things and to get involved and sleep with lots of women and set a bad example. And the challenge is not to do that. The challenge is to set a really good example and not get involved with people like Jeffrey Epstein, like Prince Andrew did. And that's why he was supposed to go out and do all these charity things. If you look at Princess Anne, she's wonderful, the things that she does, and Princess Margaret as well. And they do all this charity work, and they speak up for the people that they're representing. And that was the sort of thing that he should have done. And he should have seen that as his challenge. And I think maybe he did see that in a way. And I think maybe that's partially why he went for Meghan Markle, because he saw her as this underclass, as it were. And his mother was similar. She was the same. She was, you know, when she was advocating for the AIDS victims and things like that, and the people that were victims of mines in Africa. And I think there's this mentality of he wants to be good. He really does want to be good. So he's found somebody there that is part of a different race, traditionally hasn't really done much, hasn't added much to civilization, has been looked down on as a bit of an underclass. So he's saying, look, I don't believe in class, and I'm going to marry somebody from this other class, and I'm going to speak up for them, and I'm going to do good things for them. So I think he does understand that he needs to be setting a good example, but surely that could have been good enough for him just to not end up like Prince Andrew. Prince Andrew is an example of what happens when they go bad. And we have lots of evidence from history of princes that, you know, behaved really badly. At least they haven't behaved that badly. They could speak up more for the indigenous British, but I guess they're just not allowed to do that because of the nature of this constitutional monarchy that we have, this constitutional monarchy democracy thing, where they're just a titular head of the state, aren't they? They're not allowed to actually interfere in politics, which I think is a great shame, really, because it was always the king that you could appeal to. He was supposed to be the champion of the poor, the champion of the working classes. And now that we don't have a king or a queen that can actually take part in the politics, we don't have an advocate that we can go to.
And that's part of it. What I was saying about the royal family being in need of being reconstituted or revised in terms of what its structures and what it's there to do. The fact of the matter is that people became kings in times of old because they were lions, because they dared to do what other men wouldn't do. And they didn't get where they were because they were diplomats. And really what's happened is that Harry, and I guess to some extent William and Charles, will all, you know, they've got royal blood in their veins. They've got the genetic inheritance from the lineage that precedes them. And they must find it hellishly frustrating to be lions, and at the same time be expected to be diplomats. Now, some of them are able to cope with that more effectively than others, but you know, people who are lions, they look for causes and they look for wars to fight, and if there are no causes or no wars, then as I say, the devil makes work for idle hands, and they will that they will look to fight to create causes over which they can go to war, and I think that's what we're witnessing. And I think really what we need to what we should be doing is re-examining the role of the royal family and the relevance of the royal family in the modern world, and asking some probing and sort of serious questions as to whether it's still providing us with value for money, and whether it's actually still serving a purpose, and whether it is actually damaging to the people who are within the royal family, who you know, most of whom, apart from the ones that actually become the monarch, the rest of the royal family just spend their lives officiating at charitable events and leading the life of a diplomat, but otherwise having a fairly vacuous existence.
I would like to keep them. I mean, I like the tradition of it, but I see what you're saying there. We should find some role for them, some active role for them. But I definitely think we should keep them, even if they are just, you know, just the constitutional head. The tradition of it, that's always been the leader of the nation. We've always had one person that has the best of everything and the best education and the best wealth and understands what it's like to have luxury. I think we should have that, and that should be hereditary. It goes back to, as you say, them being lions in the past, and many of them have laid down their lives for their country, although that hasn't happened for I don't know how many centuries, 4 or 5 centuries, I think, the last time a king actually died in battle. And we have to honour our ancestors and honour our traditions. But yeah, we probably should look at some kind of a new role for them. I think Prince Andrew was a business ambassador, wasn't he? I think they do something like going to various countries like Saudi Arabia and encouraging them to do business with us, perhaps buying arms from us or something like that. Do you know much about that, Max, their business ventures that they get involved in?
Only as much as you've sort of expressed there. But, I mean, as far as Prince Andrew is concerned, in his favour, during the Falklands War, he was a distinguished helicopter pilot and placed himself in harm's way on several occasions. Or perhaps more than just several occasions, probably many occasions. And the point is that as far as Harry was concerned, Harry was sent off to Afghanistan. He joined the army, went off to Afghanistan, but he went off just as a subaltern or something like that, a fairly sort of minor officer who commanded a small group of what they like scouting tanks. They weren't really sort of battle tanks. They were reconnoitering and that sort of thing. And going back to times of old when the monarchy had more relevance, what would have happened is that Harry would have been sent out to Afghanistan with a contingent of the British Army, and he would have been put at the head of that army, and he would have been then given full reign to carve himself a kingdom in Afghanistan, and he would have been the leader of an army, and he would have conquered anybody that was in his path if he could do, and he would have created a kingdom out of there and created a civilization, and his life would have had a purpose. But because he was a royal, then the army felt that they couldn't really put him in grave danger, because if he got killed, just think how that might reflect upon the career of the colonel or the general or the field marshal who had actually put him in that position. Whereas had he been put at the head of the army, so he was then taking advice from the field marshal or the general or whatever was in charge of British forces in Afghanistan, and he then could say to them, right, we are going to civilize this part of the world. We are going to capture this town. We're going to capture this province. We're going to create a land that I will be king of. Then he would have had a purpose, and his life, you know, he could have had glory in his life instead of just having a life of fairly kind of humdrum, tepid service and officiating at charitable functions.
You know, that makes a lot more sense, Max. That really does. I mean, you really, what they should do then, they should be training them up from a very young age to be military masterminds, learn all the arts of self-defense, all the arts of battle, and then they should be there at the front of the army, strategizing with the help of other advisors, and then they would be earning their keep, wouldn't they? Because they would be taking this risk that they might die, and they would be properly leading the nation. So that was how it was in the past, then, you think?
I'm sure that was the way it was in the past. That was if you had not just the British royal family, but any noble family or royal family in times gone by, if they had too many sons, rather than keep all the sons at home with one of them being the king and all the others having nothing to do but wish that they'd been born before their older brother, and therefore becoming victim of the devil finding work for their idle hands. Those younger brothers would have been sent off to foreign lands, far-flung places. And this is why, you know, we had Vikings coming out in boats from Scandinavia and finding England and Britain and invading and carving out a little kingdom for themselves. They wouldn't necessarily call themselves a king, but they would have called themselves a lord. And they would have been the lord of the land that they captured. And that was the way things were in those days. And those were the days when a king was a proper king and not a constitutional monarch. I think the whole concept of constitutional monarchy is flawed, because it actually it causes men and women to deny their true nature. And as far as royal families and aristocracies are concerned, their true nature is to be the people who go out and conquer new lands in order to extend the influence of our people further and further around the globe. And so nowadays what we've got are princes who've been bred to be lions and who've been given a taste of what it's like to be part of the military, but who have never been given the opportunity of actually being in control of a military of their own and being allowed to go and do what nature calls for them to do.
And, you know, that makes so much sense, doesn't it, when you think about it? And that was the way that it was in the past. They were known as kings as well, weren't they? Hengist and Horsa, when they came over here, we had all these different kingdoms throughout England: Kingdom of the Angles, Kingdom of the Saxons, all these various different royal families. And that must have been what it was, expeditionary forces. I guess when you have a certain number of people that outgrow the land that you're on, and you can't produce enough, or you've got too many people there really to create enough wealth, and you've got younger members of the family, that's what they would do. They would go off with their retinue. I should imagine when they were born, they were given this retinue as well, a retinue of knights, and then you'd have the knights' families and the people who worked for the knights and the lords, and they would all disembark in their ships and head off to conquer a new land. And how do you transfer that into the world that we've got today? I guess that's, you know, that's really how the British Empire was built, was just going out and conquering these new lands. But it wasn't princes that went then, though, was it? It was representatives of Queen Victoria, wasn't it, that went out? Christopher Columbus and Sir Walter Raleigh. They were representatives of the Queen, weren't they? It wasn't actually the King that went out to America. Do you know if the King actually went out to America at all, or was that all over and done with by that time, Max?
To be honest, I don't know. But the point is, you know, we've looked at Greatest Britons, where the people concerned were born into noble families, and they then used their money to buy themselves a commission in the army, and then they advanced through the expansion of the British Empire to become not necessarily kings, but to become people who were lords, and many of them were elevated to the House of Lords and were knighted. But they were people who could carve a career by through to some extent warfare, to some extent exploration, and to some extent through constructing a civilization when they got somewhere that, you know, in a place that would have, that was a wilderness and desolate previously, and so they had a cause. And one of the things I think, you know, I've often said, one of the things that will be the next big step for mankind is when we start colonizing other planets. And that is the next big thing. Stephen Hawking said that it was essential for humanity to survive that we would, or words to this effect, that we would have to start colonizing other planets. And I believe that is the next big step for humanity. Once we've broken out of the confines of this planet that we're on, we can start sending people who've got the the caliber of the kings of old out into space to push back the frontiers and to spread our civilization across the universe. And that is going to be the next big step. But it's just a shame. It's just a shame that that people like Harry are kind of misplaced. And it isn't just people born into noble families and people born into the royal family. One of the things that made the British Empire so successful was the fact that we were so much better at fighting than the tribes people that were there before us. And I've mentioned before how when we went to North America, the American Indian population that existed there beforehand was broken down into individual tribes that were all fighting and warring against each other, and they would always try and steal each other's land and expand and steal each other's women and things of this sort, so they were fighting against each other, and then suddenly the white man arrived, and we were just another tribe, but we were a tribe that was so much better at fighting than they were, not just because we had better technology, but because we had deliberately bred a sub-strain of fighting men in this country who were second to none. And the situation is that as time has gone by and as civilization has meant that the opportunities for people to forge new empires has become restricted. What's happened is that the people who were the fighting men of Britain have had no place. Numerous instances where people, for example, grow up with no they've got genes that mean that fighting is in their blood. And yet they've got no outlet for it. And so what they look around for, as I said earlier on, they look around for a cause. And very often what they see is a group of people who have a flag. But the flag is like a long elongated flag that they wrap around their neck. And it's a football scarf with their football colours on it. And so these people go to the football matches where they will meet a rival army. And then they have fights amongst themselves and establish a kind of a hierarchy of, which army is the best of these street armies. On one hand, you've got to say, this is anachronism. This is something which is antisocial and a relic from the past. But on the other hand, what you've got to understand is that people have for centuries in this country and throughout the world, really, there have been warrior peoples who've been born with waging war in their blood, and you can't expect them all of a sudden to defy their genes and not find something to fight for or something to fight over, and that's part of the issue that's facing the royal family now, that Harry has been born into a position where he is somebody who wants to be a fighter, but he's within the confines of the royal family. He will be cloistered away and prevented and have to tip his forelock to convention and to civility and just in a either be himself or have a very frustrating life.
Yeah, that's a very interesting viewpoint there, Max. It's quite different to the one I was expecting to hear on Harry and Oprah. Thank you for that. Shall we get into Greatest Britons now, do you think?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's get into Enoch Powell, our Greatest Briton for the week. I forget how many episodes we've done of this now. I think it must be nearing 5 or 6. We'll begin with a recap of what we discussed last week. Enoch Powell joined the Ulster Unionists, and we talked about how patriotic the Irish are and how rigid the sectarian lines over there were in the 70s. He spoke out against the Prevention of Terrorism Act for encroaching on the fundamental liberties of the British people, and he remained concerned about America, not seeing them as our greatest ally, but as a competitor. We talked a bit about the election of Margaret Thatcher and how she won by taking the nationalist vote, promising to deal with immigration and then ignoring the issue once she was elected. Finally, we brought up the race riots that were starting to happen and how Powell accused the press of covering them up. And Max pointed out that Powell was anticipating a violent takeover when this was actually carried out through the ballot box and through speech laws that shielded the new communities from scrutiny. Do you want to add anything to that recap, Max?
No, I think that's a fairly thorough recap. Yes, let's press on.
Okay, in the 1980s, Powell began promoting unilateral nuclear disarmament. In a debate on the nuclear deterrent on the 3rd of March 1981, he claimed that the debate was now more political than military, that the UK did not possess an independent deterrent, and that through NATO, the UK was tied to the nuclear deterrence theory of the United States. In the debate on the address, shortly after the general election of 1983, Powell picked up on Thatcher's willingness, when asked, to use nuclear weapons as a last resort. Powell presented a scenario of what he thought the last resort would be, namely that the Soviet Union would be ready to invade the UK and had used a nuclear weapon somewhere such as Rockall to demonstrate their willingness to use it. And he said, "What would the United Kingdom do? Would it discharge Polaris, Trident or whatever against the main centres of population on the continent of Europe or in European Russia? If so, what would be the consequence? The consequence would not be that we should survive, that we should repel our antagonist, nor would it be that we should escape defeat. The consequence would be that we would make certain, as far as is humanly possible, the virtual destruction and elimination of the hope of the future in these islands. I would much sooner that the power to use it was not in the hands of any individual in this country at all." And Powell went on to say that if the Soviet invasion had already begun and the UK resorted to a retaliatory strike, the results would be the same. "We should be condemning not merely to death, but as near as may be the non-existence of our population," he said. To Powell, an invasion would take place with or without the UK's nuclear weapons, and therefore there was no point in retaining them. He said that after years of consideration, he had come to the conclusion that there were no rational grounds on which the deformation of our defence preparations in the United Kingdom by our determination to maintain a current independent nuclear deterrent can be justified. Now, I was really surprised to hear this, that he was against nuclear arms, because really that puts him in the camp of the CND, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. And they were massive in the 80s. And I can't really see Enoch Powell speaking at one of these CND rallies that went on there. Was he well known for being against nuclear disarmament, Max? What are your thoughts on this?
He was quite well known. I don't know that he would have gone to Greenham Common and spoken to the Greenham Common women or anything of that sort, but or that he would have necessarily gone to any. I don't recall seeing him or hearing of him speaking at any CND rallies. But yes, I do remember him speaking out and writing about this issue. And I think really he was quicker than most people to just realise that what we were looking at with nuclear war would be mutually assured destruction. Where I would take issue with him, though, is that once nuclear weapons exist, then it would be necessary to have nuclear weapons in order to deter somebody else from using nuclear weapons against you, because nuclear weapons are a weapon that you can only really use against a nation that doesn't have nuclear weapons to actually fire back because of mutually assured destruction. So as far as the once both the Americans and the Russians or the Soviet Union had nuclear weapons, then there was never any real prospect that the Russians would go to war with the Soviet Union, rather, would go to war with the United States of America, because it would be mutually assured destruction. There was always the possibility that either one of those two superpowers could go to war with another country and could resort to using nuclear weapons quite sparingly. It would only need to be used, I would imagine, but using nuclear weapons sparingly against that that other power. Because they would have no way of hitting back, and that's why the only example of a nuclear weapon being used in anger was the Americans dropping the two nuclear bombs on Japan, and no nuclear weapons have ever been used since. And that's just simply because anybody with any brains realizes that if you use a nuclear weapon against another country that's got nuclear weapons, then you're just effectively committing suicide.
Yeah, that mutually assured destruction, I mean, that has supposedly really kept the peace, that's what they say, since the end of the Second World War. It's because we have these nuclear weapons, we have such a huge stockpile that nobody would actually dare invading another country. But of course, there's been loads of wars that have gone on since that time, carried out mainly by America, nowadays through proxies in Syria, and they're trying to start a war at the moment with China, and they're always going on at North Korea. We've got all these little troubles that seem to flare up around the world, but apparently because we have this nuclear deterrent, then you're not going to get well, at the time you wouldn't have got the Soviet Union invading America, or you wouldn't have had America invading the Soviet Union. But a lot of people were really against this. You brought up the Greenham Common there, Max, the Greenham Common ladies, and I remember seeing them on the news, and I think they were just on Greenham Common 365 days a year. I think they had a camp there or something, and they were chaining themselves to the fences, and they were determined to get rid of nuclear weapons. What was going on there at Greenham Common, do you know?
Well, precisely what you've just been saying, actually, that these were women who, and they were women because it was at the start of the sort of big push for feminism in this country. And so these women got together and they went and camped around the American nuclear bases and the air bases, and they just basically maintained a permanent 24/7, 365 day of the year protest against the presence of those camps here in the UK. They kind of became a bit of a laughing stock because very large numbers of them tended to be very butch, and they tended to dress very eccentrically, and so they often were the butt of jokes and that sort of thing. But you know, they had a point, albeit the point they were making was wrong, because for us to have divested ourselves of nuclear weapons would have then meant that Britain could have become a victim of a nuclear power, and the only way that we can stop ourselves from becoming the victim of a nuclear power is by having a nuclear weapon of our own, and so even though we would never want to use that nuclear weapon ourselves, we have to have it whilst nuclear weapons exist in order to deter other powers from taking advantage of us. And so the Greenham Common women were wrong, and as far as Enoch Powell was concerned, he was wrong in saying that he didn't want there to be any nuclear weapons in this country. We had to have nuclear weapons. We didn't necessarily have to have a lot of them, just enough to cause such damage to any country that attacks us that it would deter them from any desire to attack Britain or to take advantage of us. It hasn't stopped wars altogether, as you quite rightly pointed out. There have been these proxy wars, and what's happened instead is that the nuclear powers of the world have, including Britain, have fought wars around the world through the use of proxy nations, where they can work to extend their influence without actually going head to head with another nuclear power.
You brought up the feminist aspect there, Max. Was it actually seen at the time as if it was a male thing to support nuclear weapons and it was a female thing to be against them?
I suppose that would have been the line of thinking that lots of the feminists would have had. You know, feminism has always portrayed anything they see as negative within society as being the fruit of the masculine mind, and so therefore, in that these women were opposed to us having a nuclear deterrent and opposed to the existence of nuclear weapons, they would regard nuclear weapons as being an invention of the male mind and something that men would want but women wouldn't want. I mean, that's wrong, of course, because it's lots of women politicians and women leaders have supported our possession of nuclear weapons for the logical reasons that I've just set forward. But logic has never been a strong suit of the left-wing mind, and so that didn't dawn on the Green and Common women.
Well, of course, the men have to have some way to defend the women. I guess they saw the missiles as phallic as well, so probably against them because of that. Well, after that, Powell returned to being anti-immigration. On the 28th of March 1981, Powell gave a speech to Ashton-under-Lyne Young Conservatives, where he attacked the conspiracy of silence between the government and the opposition over the prospective growth through births of the immigrant population, saying, "We have seen nothing yet," is a phrase that we could with advantage repeat to ourselves whenever we try to form a picture of that future. He also criticised those who believed it was too late to do anything, and that there lies the certainty of violence on a scale which can only adequately be described as civil war. He also said that the solution was a reduction in prospective numbers, as would represent re-emigration, hardly less massive than the immigration which occurred in the first place. The Shadow Home Secretary, Labour MP Roy Hattersley, criticised Powell for using Munich beer hall language, despite there being a race riot in Brixton on the 11th of April, and when on the 13th of April, an interviewer quoted to Thatcher Powell's remark that, "We have seen nothing yet," she replied, "I heard him say that, and I thought it was a very, very alarming remark, and I hope with all my heart that it isn't true." So we see here that the violence is increasing, and he's speaking out, and he's doing the right thing to speak out. If you see an upcoming hazard, it is your duty to warn people that there is a hazard coming ahead, and we need to do what we can to avoid this hazard. And he's pointing out that this hazard is being caused by the numbers of immigrants that are coming into the country that have different ways to us, that have much higher crime rates than us. Some people will say that it's five times as much crime actually is associated with some of these groups than actually with whites. All he was trying to do is prevent violence coming in the future. I mean, he describes it, he says it can only adequately be described as a civil war. And we look around now and we see the level of violence that we have, 50,000 stabbing attacks in a year, acid attacks, terrorism, grooming gangs, all these things that have been brought about by immigration. You can't blame the people themselves. It's the policy. It's the government policy of immigration which has brought all this violence about. And it was this immigration policy that he is criticising here, and he's advocating a new government policy of remigration, offering rewards to these people to go back to their homelands. And, you know, it's very sensible what he's saying here. And of course, by referring to Munich beer hall language, they're effectively calling him Hitler, aren't they? Nothing's changed, has it?
I don't know. And the fact, you know, I said last week that where Powell was wrong is that he expected much earlier that there would be much more serious inter-racial strife in this country than has taken place. And there have been these periodic spates of race riots that have taken place, where immigrant communities have effectively used violence against the host community. But these have been limited in their extent and haven't developed to be anything like as severe as Enoch Powell predicted, and that's largely because of the cowardice of our governments in terms of realizing the threat that is mounting against the indigenous people of Britain, and what they have failed to see in their appeasement of the violence that was used in these various race riots, how to see is that demography is destiny. And what's happened is that instead of the immigrant communities multiplying at a greater rate of fecundity than the indigenous British people, and then using violence and physical force to change our country, what's happened is that because our politicians have retreated and retreated and retreated and given so much and given influence to the immigrant communities and have changed the way our society is in order to try and placate the immigrant communities. What's happened is they've created a situation where the immigrant communities are still expanding at a much greater rate than the host population, the indigenous British. In fact, the indigenous British population is shrinking, and we've got the immigrant communities expanding, firstly because the immigration has continued at even greater rates than before, and because of the population growth within the immigrant communities, and so what we're facing is a situation where there will be a point later on in this century. Perhaps it's going to be 2060. It might be earlier than that. I sort of estimated 2053 as being the date where, if current trends continue, that the indigenous British people will become a minority in our own land. And so the point is that there will be a takeover. There will be a tipping point reached around about the middle of this century where the conditions in this country, the civilization of this country, the laws of this country, etc., will be determined less and less by the indigenous British people and more by people who have come here, sometimes as willing migrants who've come here because they liked what they saw of the old Britain, and they liked the fact that, you know, we were a civilized country and that we had law and order, etc. But increasingly what's happened is that the immigrants come into this country have been young people who have left countries where we have used their nations as proxies in the kind of wars that we were just speaking about a few minutes ago, that have been a substitute for direct confrontations between superpowers. And so what we've got is a large number of immigrants in this country who are from Iraq, who are from Iran, who are from Syria, who are from Amman and Turkey and places of that sort, where there have been wars and where their homes and their hometowns have been destroyed because of the proxy wars that we've been involved in. And they've come to Britain to better themselves, as they always say. But they've come to Britain with a certain amount of dislike of the British people, because you couldn't have your hometown destroyed and then go and live in the country of the people who caused your hometown to be destroyed without being resentful against the people who destroyed your hometown. And so the point is that there will increasingly be an immigrant population in this country which is resentful of Britain and what Britain was in the past, and that is resentful of the kind of proxy wars that we've become engaged in, and who will look back at their homelands and they'll see the shattered streets of Damascus, the shattered streets of Kabul and places of this sort, and they will blame us for what happened to their homelands. And so the sort of thing that Powell foresaw is not coming quickly in the sense that they would follow after his speech. They would rapidly follow after his speech race riots between the immigrant population and the indigenous British people, but there will be a reckoning that we will start to feel the heat from in the second part of this century.
It's only logical that there would be some animosity against the British, since the British were involved in encouraging these attacks in Syria and directly involved in Afghanistan. And that was something he wasn't actually having to deal with back then in the 80s. The people that were coming over from the Caribbean or coming over from the Congo or Kenya in Africa. And they weren't fleeing these war zones that had been destroyed by the very people that they were then moving into. And again, we have to point out, we're not blaming the people that move here for this. We are putting the blame squarely at the feet of the government for encouraging this and not listening to Enoch Powell and putting a stop to it. And we can also blame our mainstream media, who throughout Enoch Powell's life, they called him a racist and a hater and all the other buzzwords. Well, in July of 1981, a race riot took place in Toxteth, Liverpool, and Powell gave a speech in the Commons in which he said the riots could not be understood unless one takes into consideration the fact that in some large cities between a quarter and a half of all those under 25 were either immigrant or descended from immigrants. He read out a letter he had received from a member of the public about immigration that included the line, "As they continue to multiply, and as we can't retreat further, there must be conflict." A Labour MP, Martin Flannery, responded by saying Powell was making a National Front speech. Powell predicted either inner London would become ungovernable or we would see violence that could only effectively be described as civil war. Flannery intervened again to ask what Powell knew about inner cities. And I'll just stop there just to point out the amount of violence that we now have in London, I think, is what he was referring to there as the sort of violence that we would see in a civil war. And where he points out that parts of London would become ungovernable, we do have these ungovernable, lawless zones. We have them all the way across Europe, these areas that the police can't go into, the emergency services can't go in there at all. And that would fulfill this description here of ungovernable. Well, Powell replied to this. He said, "I was a member for Wolverhampton for a quarter of a century. What I saw in those early years of the development of this problem in Wolverhampton has made it impossible for me ever to dissociate myself from this gigantic and tragic problem." He also criticised the view that the causes of the riots were economic. "Are we seriously saying that so long as there is poverty, unemployment and deprivation, our cities will be torn to pieces, that the police in them will be the objects of attack, and that we shall destroy our own environment? Of course not." Dame Judith Hart attacked his speech as an evil incitement to riot. Powell replied, "I am within the judgment of the House, as I am within the judgment of the people of this country, and I am content to stand before either tribunal." After the Scarman report on the riots was published, Powell gave a speech on the 10th of December in the Commons. He disagreed with Scarman when he said the black community was alienated because it was economically disadvantaged, pointing out that the black community was alienated because it was alien. He said tensions would worsen because the non-white population was growing, whereas in Lambeth it was 25%, in those of secondary school age it was 40%. Powell said that the government should be honest with the people and tell them that in 30 years' time the black population of Lambeth will have doubled in size. In 1985, more race riots broke out between the black community and the police in London and in Birmingham, leading Powell to repeat his warning that ethnic civil conflict would be the ultimate outcome of foreign mass migration into the British Isles, and he reissued his call for a government-sponsored programme of repatriation. So we can see that everything that he predicted in the 60s is coming true. There is now more and more violence is occurring, race riots are occurring, it's rapidly starting to get to the point where the white people in Lambeth are going to be a minority. I guess he's talking about London there. London must have been about 40% non-white at the time, and of course now it's 60%, and white people actually are the minority in our capital city. I am impressed with the way he is speaking here in the House of Commons. I mean, he's been very forthright here. He's coming back with just the right answers to the people that are criticising him. To say that he doesn't know what he's talking about in inner cities when he's been in Wolverhampton for a quarter of a century, that's just ridiculous. And I think it's a good point that he makes that these riots are not economic. You know, you get lots of poor areas that have white people in them and they don't riot and they don't have a massive crime rate. It's because of the rioting and the crime rate that businesses don't want to go in these areas, and that's why they have less money in them. If you have a look at America, you look at the poorest parts of America, they're in Appalachia, they're 99.9% white, and they also have the lowest crime rates in America. If you look at the areas that are majority black, places like Detroit, Chicago, Baltimore, they have massive crime rates, massive murder rates. So you really, you know, that's all you need to look at. And if you still think, well, those areas are multicultural, then all you have to do is look at Africa and look at South Africa in particular, in Johannesburg and places like that, to see that they are the most violent countries in the world. In fact, the top 10 countries in the world are all non-white countries. It's not because these people don't have any money that they commit these crimes. It's because they are far more likely to commit crimes that people don't want to invest there. They don't want to put the businesses there if they think the business is going to get burned down. And this is what we see happening with these Black Lives Matter riots in America this summer. $5 billion worth of damage was caused to businesses in those riots. So what we're talking now is 30 years after he was speaking here, and we're still suffering with these race riots. We're still suffering with the problems caused by multiculturalism. And Enoch Powell was a great hero to our people, I think, in speaking about this. The more we do this series, the more respect I have for this man, and I can see that he really rightfully is one of our greatest Britons. And Max, what are your thoughts on this increase in the race riots here?
Yeah, I think I would agree with everything you've just said, actually. It's just such a great shame that, you know, here we are 30 years later and we're still having the same conversations. And although things haven't progressed quite as quickly as I think Powell predicted, we can see that things are moving in that direction. And the great sadness to me, really, is that rather than recognizing the danger that we've all been placed in by allowing continued migration allowing it to continue, what's happened is that the successive governments have tried to criminalize discussion of the consequences of continued mass immigration, you know, as if there was a multicultural society somewhere in the world which isn't torn by civil war, that isn't torn by race riots, that isn't torn by very high levels of crime. You know, that they argue that that we mustn't be allowed to speculate as to what is the outcome, or to point out to what is the out to others what the outcome is of continued mass immigration into this country. I remember during the period that National Action were banned, that the Home Secretary, I think it was at the time, pointed to the fact that members of National Action believed that there would be a race riot in this there would be a future race war in this country, and the fact that they believed that there would be a race war in this country was kind of put forward by the Home Secretary as if that in itself was justification for banning these people and locking them up. Now, you don't have to advocate a race war, and I don't advocate a race war. I don't want there to be a race war. I wouldn't go out of my way to provoke a race war or anything of that sort. But I can foresee that something of that sort could very well happen and probably will at some point in the future if we continue to allow mass immigration into this country, and particularly if we continue to allow mass immigration into this country from countries where those people are disgruntled with us because we've been involved in proxy wars that have destroyed their own homelands.
Well, I think that's what he's referring to here, isn't it? When he's talking about civil war, he's talking about civil war along racial lines, along sectarian lines. And it's not like this isn't something that's happened throughout our history. It is. It's been the cause of all the civil wars. It's always been territorial disputes between two different types of people. He's trying to prevent that here. And we're still trying to prevent it here today at Radio Albion. You know, that's why we're discussing this. We want to prevent this from happening. We don't want there to be a war between different peoples on British soil. And we think the best way to prevent that from happening is to have the peoples living separately. There's nothing hateful about that at all. It's all about wishing to avoid violence. It's all about wishing to avoid war and just wishing for the different peoples of the world to prosper, because we certainly aren't prospering all living together within one territory. It's just a recipe for conflict and strife, as we see time and time again. But thankfully, we do have these gifted, eloquent spokesman like Enoch Powell to raise this point. And he did have a lot of support. And I do believe we will have others that arrive in the future with that are gifted and eloquent and can speak up for us. And I do have faith that something will eventually have to be done about this. We're not going to go into the, whatever the word is, the cold, dark night, quietly, at least. They may try to silence us, but that doesn't prevent these things from happening. As you pointed out, Max, these race riots were happening, and just to ban people from talking about them, that hasn't stopped the race riots, has it? They're still happening. They're happening in America this year. The last one to happen in Britain, I guess, was in Croydon. You could say that they have calmed down. We don't have so much of them now, but instead we just have a constant level of violence that is going on all the time. 50,000 stabbings last year. I think there's a murder every day. So there may not actually be a war on the streets, but there is this increased level of violence, and that's what we are seeking to avoid with the discussions that we have here at Radio Albion. Max, is there anything else you'd like to add to that, or shall we call it a day for today?
Well, just that in order to dull the senses and dull the wits of the Indigenous British people, and to stop us thinking for ourselves, what we have nowadays as a result of mass immigration is this constant propaganda campaign that's being waged through the mass media, where we are being made to feel that we already are a multicultural society. In fact, not just a multicultural society, but a society in which non-white people are the majority. And I'm reminded of this constant campaign every time I turn on a television set, because what I see there are adverts now. And very often you can watch an entire advertising break on one of the commercial channels. You can watch an entire advertising break where not a single white person will feature in any of the adverts that are being shown. And so we're in a situation now where white people are being softened up and being made to feel that we actually don't really exist, and that we don't really have, because we don't really exist, we don't have any right to argue for our, in our own ethnic interests, that we have to just accept that other people have got an ethnic interest, but we don't, and that our place in this world is just to accept the changes that are taking place. And of course, that's not the case.
And of course, so that goes hand in hand with the rewriting of our history, sort of preparing us to be replaced. But and the more they do it, the more people wake up to it and start organizing and trying to advocate for our people, as Patriotic Alternative are doing. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.